Welcome to Aware. We are dedicated to communicating information that inspires your positive growth and change. Are you interested in a peaceful planet? Are you interested in optimal health? Are you living with purpose? Are you enjoying your life? We realize each person can make a difference, and our mission is to empower your awareness. The choices that you make in every moment shape your life, and we encourage you to realize that you have your own answers and to always listen to your own truth. We invite you to stay aware. Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to The Aware Show. I am Lisa Garr, and it is so wonderful to be here with you today. Thank you so much for joining me. And I want to just encourage you, if you go to my website and check it out, theawareshow.com, you can always check out where I am. We've got a new series of shows launching on the Gaia Network, and you can check that out at Inspirations on Gaia, and it's GAIA.com. A lot of great new shows coming up. I've been going back and forth to Boulder, Colorado, where I tape those, and just I love it there. It's so nice. But it's also wonderful here, too. So that's where I am, and Hay House Radio and all sorts of great places. So check all that out there. Because what I do is what I love. I love this opportunity to find people that really, truly inspire change in other people. And that is definitely the case with my guest today, Teal Swan. Teal is an extraordinary human being. She's been through so much in her life, but her incredible success, you know, she's a huge YouTube sensation and over, you know, probably 500,000 subscribers at this point and 50 million views and tons of people on Facebook and Insta, but she is a spiritual catalyst. And that's her name on all those social media outlets is The Spiritual Catalyst, because she has been through loneliness, isolation, severe childhood trauma, so many different things that have shaped her life. And to come out of it as a teacher rather than a victim is such a beautiful journey that she is still on. She has a new book called The Anatomy of Loneliness, and I would say that this is addressing a huge epidemic of not only loneliness, but the need to belong. And I want to say welcome, Teal. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me. It's wonderful to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. So I just have to ask you a little bit about your the book, The Completion Process, the practice of putting yourself back together again. Dude. You have done just that. You have put yourself together from something that most people would consider life-shattering, something that could not easily come back from. Can you share with us a little bit about your story, about being born a very sensitive child, extrasensory, actually, child?
Yeah, I was born with spiritual gifts, and I was born into a family that didn't have any awareness of any of that kind of stuff. They were real scientific. So when I was talking about the stuff that I was seeing around people that you shouldn't be able to see or hearing around people that you shouldn't be able to hear, my parents kind of threw their hands up in the air and was like, what are we supposed to do with this kid? Unfortunately, there was a person that was around them in their social group who was actually part of a cult. He was a super psychopathic guy. And when they said, you know, we don't know what to do with this kid and these abilities, he came in and said, I know what to do with them. And my parents trusted him. And so he became kind of like a mentor, but unbeknownst to my parents, of course, it wasn't just like this good relationship. I was getting tortured by him. I was getting prostituted by him. I was getting used to lure children into the car and then who would then get murdered. It was like really horrific. Mm. And that went on for 13 straight years. You know, him basically saying he was going to kill the whole family if I said anything, always a cover up for why I came home with injuries. So,
wow.
I mean, and my life was just over.
And your, yes, most people would think. And your parents didn't say or feel anything happening? Didn't see it?
Oh, they knew that stuff was happening. But it was like there was always an excuse for why. And when my mood kept getting worse and worse and worse and worse and worse, it was like, what are we, you know, what's wrong with this kid? So I was drugged to doctors. I was drugged to psychologists, psychiatrists. And every single one of them had a different answer. And, of course, I wasn't talking. So even though there was a few of them who were like, this girl is getting abused, they'd investigate my parents because, you know, mentally it's like, well, they can't be anybody else, right? Mm-hmm. And they couldn't find anything with my parents, so everyone missed it.
and you had to cope in some way. What was your coping skill at the time?
Horses? Oh, yeah. I was a complete horse freak. And I grew up in a place where it's like you have your horse in your backyard. So horses was my obsession, and I'm pretty sure it's the reason that I even maintained any emotional quotient.
I believe you. My daughter's a big horse person, too, and she heals through horses. Yeah, yeah. She feels like she flies when she's with them. Mm-hmm. Is that, other than horses, did you have to cope in a way of disconnection, and how did you put all of that back together again?
Well, my main, aside from horses, which is sort of, you know, it's cute, but I was a cutter, so my coping skills were more along the addiction line and really unhealthy coping mechanisms, which I got out with that in that same state. And the primary way, actually, that a human being functions through severe abuse is through fragmentation. The consciousness splits into different parts. Mm-hmm. So when I got away, I had 12 distinct personalities. And it was like, you know, obviously existing in standard society with that kind of wounding was so incredibly difficult that people couldn't handle being around me for very long, you know, because it was like dissociative seizures. And if it wasn't that, it was flipping out that the neighbors had somebody in their basement, you know, because that was what I was used to. And all of this completely erratic behavior and zero sexual boundaries, too, which made really great relationships, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So these different pieces of yourself, were you able to see that that was happening?
Yeah. Yeah, I was. I just didn't know what to do about it. Like, you know, I've got a really high IQ, so I was not the kind of person who is ignorant about most of this stuff. It was just that I didn't have an answer, and that was part of what was so frustrating. Because to be, like, super smart, but to still not know what to do with yourself and then not be able to meet anybody else who knows, my gosh, I just felt like this, you know, it's a death sentence is what I got in my childhood, which is how a lot of people who have been abused feel. It just sort of feels like a scarlet letter, and that's your life. You know?
You said your life was over.
Yeah.
Did you try?
Yeah, I attempted suicide, yeah. Four times.
Yeah, I was going to say several times. Why do you think that didn't work, Teal?
You know what? This is the point at which I am somewhat believing in a higher power, regardless of how much torture I was going through, because there would be a whole day where I'd be completely isolated by myself, trying to deal with all the other stuff that was going on, you know, behind everybody's back, and I would make a decision to commit suicide, and that, like, the minute that I had a knife to my throat is the minute my dad would walk through the door. And that happened several times.
Mm.
Other times it was like I'm in such an incredibly intense emotional state and in attempting to commit suicide in really graphic ways that I just did not accomplish it, you know. Because people who try to commit suicide, obviously, their different methods for doing so have a lot to do with what they're trying to accomplish. People who tend to cry out for help and are desperate want to go for more graphic ways of killing themselves as opposed to get it done really fast and in a straightforward way.
So yours was a cry for help and it showed up.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And did you get that help?
No.
Wow.
No, that's the irony.
Yeah, you didn't. But, I mean, when you see people going through this now that come to you and obviously reach out to you and who are suffering, what do you see and how do you connect with them?
Oh, gosh, it's so easy for me because I understand what kind of a space of suffering you have to be in to be at that precipice. I mean, to make it so that death is not a jumping off of a cliff, it's literally just a walking over a molehill type of an experience. So it's very easy for me to go to that emotional space. And when you relate to that, you can talk to somebody from that standpoint. The worst thing you can ever say to somebody who's suicidal is you have a lot to live for, because you don't. And another bad thing to say is, you know, you're going to hurt people, because you're not. From that perspective, you're going to help people by being gone.
Mm, that's what you feel.
So, yeah. So, like, it's about talking to a person from where they are. Like, it's a reality that their life is sucking. Otherwise, they wouldn't be doing that. So it's a sort of now what type of experience. And we need to not be afraid of having those types of conversations.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Because it seems that death is easier than life.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, much easier. One would think. But having done this, and I've been through this near-death experience, and it's actually beautiful. in a way.
Yep.
It's beautiful, but it doesn't solve problems.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And as much as we know about the soul, it comes back to figure it out again. So,
well, I know. That's what frustrates me the most.
Yeah. So you have to kind of figure it out in this lifetime. What do you mean that frustrates you?
Well, I relate to how being in that space where it's just, can you imagine anything worse? It's like a death sentence on top of a death sentence. If you, life is so painful, you want to get out of it. But the only reason you don't kill yourself is because you know you're coming back. I mean, that in and of itself feels like the worst trap.
Right. As if there aren't enough traps already.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, meeting people where they are, which is who you are, you're first of all, very open and candid and vulnerable, and you're able to speak about this so other people can hear that you are still speaking about it and have survived this. What was the first
yes.
thing that you did, Teal, when you really, your first thing that worked towards your survival?
My first thing that worked is that I started to use suicide as a safety net. So, you know, I could see that suicidality was me sitting on the fence. It was basically, I'm not committed to life, but I also haven't killed myself yet, so I'm not fully committed to death. So I'm basically nowhere. And I understood enough, because I was an athlete my whole life, you know, it's kind of another way that I coped. I understood that if you don't throw yourself 100% into something, nothing is going to come out of it. So I'm like, well, this is crap. I'm just fence sitting. Like, I'm not throwing my energy into life, so nothing can happen in life, and I'm not throwing my energy into death. Well, that's dumb. So basically, I was like, you know what? I can always kill myself in a second. Like, death is always a backup. That's the reality. And so if I can always kill myself and I started with 5 minutes, I can always kill myself in 5 minutes. What am I going to do with these 5 minutes? But I have to commit 100% to throwing my energy into those 5 minutes, into life completely. And I don't even think about suicide for those 5 minutes. And what I found is that the more that I threw my energy into life, the easier it was to make actual changes in life that made it better. And so that 5 minutes turned into, I can always kill myself in 10 minutes. Okay, what can I do with these 10 minutes? And then it was an hour, and then it was a day, and then it was like a week. And so I kept extending it and extending it to the point where I no longer had the urge.
What would you do with those first five minutes?
Well, the first 5 minutes, all that I could do in those moments was to just go in the direction of what felt like relief. So the first time I ever did that exercise, I just turned on a television program. It was pretty distracting in nature. You know, I didn't have enough personal energy towards life to say, okay, well, I'm going to move across country. It was literally just like, all right, in these 5 minutes, I'm going to do whatever feels good in this moment. So I'm turning on a movie. I think the movie that I turned on was Neverending Story or something. Mm-hmm. But I would not let myself think about anything other than what was happening on the screen. And then the next time I did that, I was focusing on things that I liked. That was so painful at first, my God. But, you know, I'd look around and I'd say, okay, well, what do I like in the room that I'm sitting in? I just get to 100% focus only on the things that I like. And to begin with, it would be things like, oh, I like the way that the light is reflecting off of the wall in that way. I like the coziness of the covers that I'm sitting in. And it would just be like a mental list.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So present time.
Oh, yeah. But then it changed because, you know, then you extend it to an hour. It's like, what am I going to do with this hour? Okay, so if I'm fully committing to life, I don't want to live where I'm living anymore. That was what I came to. So mm-hmm. I don't care really at this point if I'm throwing myself into it. I don't care whether this is or isn't going to work. I don't care whether it makes sense. I'm no longer making rational decisions anymore. Mm-hmm. I'm making a decision in favor of what feels good. So I would get in the car and just drive 2 hours away to, I mean, anywhere that I wanted to go.
Good that you could drive, and that was right when you started to drive?
Yeah, I was like, well, I was 19, so I started to drive at 16, so it was 3 years later.
Okay. But, yeah, that you would have probably hit the pedal as hard as you could to get as far away from where you were as
oh,
you
yeah.
could. But then would you go back?
Yeah, I'd go back, and then it was skiing. So I threw myself in the woods. Okay, so if I have to do anything, I can only do what feels good, obviously, because that's the rule of thumb when you're trying to commit to life again. What do I like? Okay, I like skiing, kind of. Let's go try that. And I would spend the whole day there, and I would pour myself into it. So I'm going to focus on the way that I'm edging my skis. Mm-hmm. I'm going to focus on the best way to improve my technique. And I would not let myself think about suicide for the whole day. And skiing turned into a complete obsession. And then I had my very first thought of maybe I could be a professional skier. And that was the one thought that brought me into the future. If you're super suicidal, there is no future. It's just torture. So even the fact that that thought occurred within me, maybe I do have a future and this could be my future, that was like a saving grace.
That gives you some sense of what is possible.
Yes.
Is jumping from just the future to possibility, though, too big of a jump?
The future to possibility?
Yeah. So if you were jumping from, okay, I can do this tomorrow and I could maybe be a professional skier, and then you go, some people say, think about the possibilities. Is that just too, it was just micro steps that you had to take, right?
Well, you know, I would never want somebody to try that out in the beginning because it's like so not believable.
Right.
I feel like one of the biggest mistakes we make in the self-help field and the spiritual field and the psychological field is that we give people these huge vibrational gaps to jump that they don't have any access to. And by doing that, we actually make it worse. It's almost like, okay, you know, tell yourself you love yourself. And when a person does that from a space of self-hate, now it just makes you more aware of how much you hate yourself. So I would not advise, obviously, anybody jumping to, oh, the future is going to hold unlimited potential.
Brightness. That's what I was trying to ask. And you put that exactly the way that I was thinking. It's just, yeah, it's not within the realm of possibility to go that love, self-love and all that. It's not not within the cards. Yeah, yeah. So you're and people, by the way, if they want to check out Teal Swan's videos, you can go to YouTube and you can look up The Spiritual Catalyst, because there's really a way to identify with what it means to survive severe childhood abuse. But I want to ask you about that word, survive. Would you call it survival, or would you change that word at all?
I would call it survival in the beginning, but what survival turns into eventually is thriving, which is a completely different way of life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, in the beginning, yeah, that's all it is. It's literally what can make me draw my next breath.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And now, speaking of jump, how did you ever find this voice within you to eventually lead to talking about happiness or any relationships, intimacy? How did you get to that place, Teal?
Well, there was a certain point in my healing process where I realized that I couldn't continue to deny all of these aspects, because in my mind, obviously, this guy targeted me based on my abilities, so I didn't want anything to do with it for a long time. And, you know, that which you avoid, you're going back to. So part of my healing journey, it came to the point where I was like, I can't keep running away from this. Like, nothing has happened. It hasn't gone away. I'm still the athlete at the top of the hill that's, like, stressing out about the fact that I can visually see the emotional state of the person next to me. So I started to see people one-on-one. That was my way of opening the door up. And when I saw people for one-on-one, it was what I was doing when I was a kid, actually. You know, they'd come in and be like, okay, well, this is what I see in your energy field. This is what I see in your body. It was a lot more medical intuitive work at that point.
Ah.
But obviously, as an extrasensory, there's a lot about this universe that's just obvious to you that's not really obvious to people who are completely plugged into the physical dimension.
Mm-hmm.
So I started talking to people about these things, and it blew my mind how much most people didn't know. And it blew my mind more than that based on knowing those things that they didn't know, they could completely transform their life. So I started to see for the very first time the potential of these abilities, not just causing damage, but actually having the capacity to change people's lives. And I started, you know, looking at how far that could go. I was looking at homeless people first and foremost. You know, they're just on the streets, mostly addicts, have no idea about the way that the universe is working, have no idea how to get themselves out of the situation. And I was like, wow, you know, I got to bring this message beyond just the people who can pay for an hour session with me. And how am I going to do that? I'm going to write a book. So I did that, and it blew up. And then, you know, how can I reach more people? Let's do a YouTube series. And because right at the beginning of YouTube being anything big. So I jumped on there and just started answering people's questions.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the Ask Teal series that I started. And, I mean, it was really second nature. I got to tell you the honest truth. I would love to be like, oh, it was so hard at first. It really wasn't. It was like I was born to do this stuff. I got on stage, and I was safer there than anywhere else. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're in your element as well, and you're helping people. And you have, through identifying with them and allowing them to identify with you. I saw a great piece that you were talking about this law of mirroring. Everything in you reflects in your external life.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that and your example? Like, how could that possibly relate to what was going on inside of you through all those years of abuse?
Well, the way that I want people to start looking at the universe is that a human being, or every living being, is in fact a fractal of the greater universe. So even by virtue of being born, you are born with all potentials inherent within you and all things. And it's almost like as we experience our life, the things that we're interacting with, most of which we have chosen before coming in, act like triggers that awaken certain aspects and other aspects stay dormant. Mm. So a baby, for example, already has all of these aspects within. And we have to accept the fact that the universe is all of these polarities. It is what we would call evil. It is what we would call goodness and everything in between.
Mm. So, and we're all born with every single piece of that. But so triggers, yeah. Do you think that we kind of come in with that path to light those certain triggers up? Forgiveness.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah, those types of
100%.
Things.
100%. And the ancestral thing is such a big deal because you can look at the progression of an individual's consciousness, but you can also look at the progression of a whole family line. And when you come into a physical incarnation, you are choosing to become the furthest most progression of that certain family line. But that means you're going to have to encode yourself with not just the positive aspects of that family line, but also the negative aspects. For example, the coping mechanisms that have run through generations that are no longer working.
Isn't that interesting how it does? It's handed down. And even though there are studies that even though you don't know the person at all, you could have been adopted into another family and still repeat the patterns from your original birth parents.
Yep.
It's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, well, most people don't understand that genetics is a 12-dimensional thing. It's not like a one-dimensional thing. It's not purely physical. So you're opting into, you basically contain every memory of every single ancestor that came before you.
When you say it like that, it's so daunting. It's like you have 12 dimensions of the system. I mean, say addiction. Say it goes back 12 dimensions. That's daunting. I mean, how do you possibly get over that? How do you break the pattern, Teal?
Well, it's very simple. Because if it's an issue, it's going to show up in your life right now. So you deal with yourself right now. You are it's almost like I want people to see themselves as the progression of the family line. So it's not about going back and healing your great grandmother. About the fact that if that pattern showed up in you and you shift the pattern, you have changed the programming inherent in the consciousness of your family line. That changes the pattern of the program, not just for you in your life, but for every single one of your progeny.
Right, right. Yeah. It definitely helps being a parent, too, because you see how what you do is a direct, it's a mirror for the person that you're raising in the house with you. No matter what, they're going to figure it out. And so it really
isn't it
helps.
Fun? It's so much fun.
Oh,
being
so
a parent
great.
Is so much fun.
It's great. It's great because it shows you more than anything. It's probably one of the best psychology sessions that you could ever have is showing right to you in your face and have it reflect back to you. So now your latest book, Anatomy of Loneliness. And this is a huge, as you say, epidemic in terms of our society, this increasing suicide rates and mental illness and so forth. How do you connect loneliness to mental illness?
Okay, this is fun. All right, so what we don't understand about most of these quote-unquote mental illnesses is that it creates a parallel reality. That's why people, you know, would label somebody ill, because we're looking at somebody and saying there's something not right with this. So just that idea of looking at somebody and saying this isn't right, the way that this person feels is not right, it means that they're perceiving something that we are not perceiving. That difference in perceptual realities is actually a parallel reality, but in the same room. And to make that make more sense, I'll go back to a childhood experience. Let's say that you've got, and I'm going to give you a normal one. Let's say that you've got a child who's 3 years old, and that 3 year old has a parent that comes up to them and says, "Oh, guess what? We just had a baby." But here's the thing. You're going to have to basically give up a lot of time with us because this baby's going to take so much energy. And you should be glad about the fact that you have this baby because now you have a sibling that's hanging around.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to the parent, this is a joyous thing to bring this baby into the home, even though it's increasing stress and all of this. But to a child, from their perspective, it is exactly the same emotional experience as if, say, your husband walks through the door today and said, you know what? Sorry, I just fell in love with somebody else. But you should be happy about it because now you have somebody else to spend some time with. But here's the thing. Since it's a new relationship, I'm going to be spending a lot more time with them. That is the emotional experience that happens when we do not prepare our children for a new baby in the house. It is that extreme. So you could consider there being a different perceptual reality happening in the child and happening in the adult. And these different perceptual realities, they occur all the time. But when it comes to mental illness, this is what is happening. It's creating such an intense sensation of isolation in these individuals. And if you run down the whole gambit, like it doesn't matter which one you go to, it's just a different perceptual reality. But schizophrenics, you know, that's pretty freaking obvious. They live in a different perceptual reality. To us, there is nobody chasing you. To them, yes, there is somebody chasing me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we actually enhance the problem when we will not join them in their reality, when we keep trying to drag them into ours.
What would you do instead? Are you a parent, by the way?
Yes, I am. I have a son who's 9.
Ah, awesome. All right, so what would you do instead? How do you bring them in? How do you bring them into your reality or their reality? Join their reality.
How do I join the reality? I have to, okay, the first thing I have to accept is it doesn't matter whether my judgment is that his perception is right or wrong, it is valid, and I have to treat it as such. That means no emotional invalidation, first and foremost. You can think about the emotions as being the core of a child. The emotions is the most important thing to parent to. So if he comes up and let's say we're at a birthday party and he's feeling jealous and upset because everybody else is getting a present, I can't do things that make him believe that that sensation is inaccurate. I have to meet him where he is as if it is valid. So the first thing I do is validate the emotion. Oh, I see, and it's mirroring. I see that you're feeling really jealous. I could see how somebody would feel jealous when it seems like somebody else is getting all the presents. When you validate a child, you wait for them to work a little bit with the emotion. It's sort of like they're digesting it because they've just been seen. That causes the emotion to be able to play forward a little bit. And then you have the opening to try to give them a different way of seeing the experience. But you keep working with it and working with it until you find the thing that makes them feel relief. So you're working within the construct of their perceptual reality instead of expecting them to adopt yours.
Mm. Does it just loosen it up so that the person or the child can move forward, can move on?
Yes, and it doesn't put them at war with themselves. You actually, I could cause, even in something that benign, I could cause a state of fragmentation within my son.
Gotcha.
If I say, it's not right to feel jealous right now, come on, it was your birthday last month, and we did the same thing last month for you that we're doing for this kid now. What I've just taught him is his emotions are wrong. He doesn't have a reason to feel that way. So immediately a person goes, okay, well, now I'm dealing with this huge conflict internally, which is that I feel something that I shouldn't feel. Now, I put him at war with his own emotional being, and I've given him no opportunity for resolution.
Got it. I mean, you got to write a parenting book. This is, it's great, but it's all, I mean, what I'm hearing from you is it's all about anti-fragmentation. It's all these different pieces that get disengaged from us as we go through the human experience and we disenfranchise them, actually push them, we disown them. And then eventually we wind up as an adult, as a sliver, a tiny little chunk of who we are.
Yes.
And that's what loneliness is.
Yeah, basically. You can't have a perception of external fragmentation, which is what you're perceiving. If I feel lonely in my life in general, I perceive a separation between me and other things. Now, if you think about life as a mirror, that means I have internal fragmentation inside. That means I have cut myself off from aspects of me internally.
Mm. Hmm. And bringing those together, I mean, take for example, someone who, as you said, is physically cutting themselves. And that's a sign of cutting themselves off from a certain part of themselves.
Yes.
How would you help them heal that or help them bring together that part of themselves that they want to cut off?
Well, first you got to make them become aware of the fact that they have an aspect that they're trying to cut off. If somebody is turned against themselves in that way, it's a byproduct of somebody else turning against that aspect.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about, you know, who is that person turning against this aspect? Obviously, if I'm working with a kid that's doing that, we're talking to the parents because the dominant pattern with cutting actually occurs between kids and their moms.
Yeah.
And essentially what's happening is that the kid is in a negative emotional space and then that urge to cut is is basically like it's actually similar to bulimia. It's I need to get rid of this emotion. And then, but the parents won't have it. It's like you don't have a valid reason to feel the way you're feeling. And so all of that vomit, emotional vomit, basically goes back in. So the being starts to become poisoned. And so often, you know, cutters will basically feel like bleeding themselves is getting rid of that quote-unquote poison, which is that ingested emotion that wasn't allowed to go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So I will be doing a lot of interactions between family members in terms of how to deal with emotions so that there can actually be a bleeding out of emotions when there is negativity. And it doesn't have to be this, well, stuff it down and I'm not going to have it type of energy. But usually a parent has turned against parts of the child that contain those emotions. So let's say that the child is feeling particularly vulnerable and there's no space in this family for vulnerability. Then that cutting away of oneself will be, I want to get rid of the vulnerable aspect of self. So all we have to do is to provide the container and the safe space and a different way of dealing with that part. Instead of shaming it for being vulnerable or being like, well, there's no reason to feel that way, we create a safe, super validating environment for that part.
However, though, the parent that you're probably speaking with isn't conscious of the separation that they're in either. Maybe they're going through something traumatic themselves, like a painful divorce or a death or something that's causing them to be disenfranchised.
Well, suffering creates suffering, creates suffering.
More of the same. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So bringing parts of yourself back together again, and this also has to do with loneliness and bringing parts of... Now, in terms of the anatomy of loneliness, is it important to find those pieces and reconnect yourself before you start connecting with others?
Oh, hell no. No, see, I don't draw the distinction that most people draw, because if it's a mirror, it's the same both ways. And I'm not saying, like, what's different about a mirror is one is a reflection and one is real. Both are real. There is nothing more real about self-love than there is about loving somebody else. There is no difference. If you're going to accept the reality of oneness in this universe, it doesn't matter whether you're loving something external or internal. It's all the same. So what you'll notice with this type of process when you start to integrate aspects of yourself is that it reflects instantaneously outside and vice versa. That's actually what the universe is trying to do by bringing us these relationships. It brings us relationships with people who are mirroring the parts of us that we have denied. And by loving them, we are actually loving that part of us. That's how the universe is trying to get us to arrive at reintegration, actually. It's through these external relationships because we're so avoidant in them with them internally.
The universe brings us relationships that are mirroring what we are missing. What did you say? That we what?
Yes. We find relationships externally, the ones that are totally magnetic, right?
Mm-hmm.
The ones that we can't avoid. Those relationships are brought to us specifically because they represent parts that we have lost in ourselves long ago, either cut off because we wanted nothing to do with those parts because we learned that they were wrong in some way, or else woefully let go of.
So I have to ask, in your doing all of this work, have you asked yourself that question? How did you attract your childhood experience? Yeah. How?
No, I'm the one exception to the rule. No. Yeah, I do, actually, and it's my mother. I opted into a relationship, a very difficult relationship, with a mother who was incredibly incompatible to me. So, and that was an intention that I had before coming into this life. So it wasn't like I really wanted a free ride here. And given what I'm doing in my work now, I understand that. Because the reality is that if I was just an extrasensory, I'd be really good at telling you what the universe is about. I would be horrible at connecting the dots between the truth in this greater universe and human suffering. It's too far of a gap. So I became a bridge based off of going through that experience. It's something that I wanted before coming in here, but you're not going to let, you got to go balls deep if you want to really connect with something. So I did that. And by virtue of coming into this experience with my mother and feeling so incredibly intensely rejected, the man in my childhood who came in was actually a mirror of that.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Wow. Yeah, there are people that I interview that have, you know, just came in to connect the dots spiritually. You have a totally different path. Yes, and it's to bring, yes, to connect this bridge for people that are experienced. And it's so important to address the loneliness point. This need to belong, it shows up everywhere. that shows up. And and I was thinking about this. It has to do, you know, a long time ago, I mean, the tribe and getting, you know, being a part of the tribe. And there's even ceremony to be a part of the tribe. And I'm talking a long time ago. But it's ingrained in our DNA. And so we go in through life and we feel like we're missing out, or high school is insane. And it's all these things that just totally, completely keep going with the disenfranchisement. How do you go against something that's your DNA of wanting to belong?
You don't.
Okay.
Oh, I piss everybody in the spiritual field off because I cannot stand the fact that we're... Okay, so here's the thing. Most people in the spiritual field arrived at the spiritual field because they did not get what they needed out of relationships. People who get what they need out of relationships don't turn to God. So basically, you've got an entire field full of people who never got their needs met from people and are trying to find some spiritual justification for not needing those things. So if you look through the spiritual field, half the people who are out there or more are trying to teach you how to deny a need or how to not need it. And I am literally calling BS on this. And I'm saying, you know what? Stop working against it. You need to start working with your biology. You need to stop using divinity as a way to escape your humanity and embrace your humanity. You need belonging. That is a human need. You also need to be around people. We need human connection. End of story. And if you try to get away from it, you're going to suffer and make other people suffer. So
yeah,
it's about getting it.
It is. Here's an example. So I also host Coast to Coast, and I interview a lot of people who have these experiences of being abducted or visited by aliens and so forth, but they find a huge community of other people that feel the same way. So is that the same thing?
Same thing as what?
Feeling like you are belonging to a group, even though it might not be it might not make the most sense. Do you know what I mean?
Well, in all things, you've got shadow and light. So you've got shadow belonging, and you've also got light forms of belonging. The aim should be to find the purest form of connection and belonging that you can find from wherever you are.
Okay.
And a lot of people need a step. So sometimes, you know, it's like people will get into AA, for example, and that will be a really good step. And then there comes a point where I'm ready to disidentify as an addict, and now I'm taking the next step. And maybe that means I'm moving away from a group of people that are completely identified with the only reason we belong with each other is because of a dysfunction. But, I mean, to each his own, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody needs these steps.
Mm-hmm. So, right, exactly. Well, let's talk about in your book you talk about these three pillars of loneliness. Pillar of separation, the pillar of shame, and pillar of fear. Can you talk a little bit about those?
Yeah. The pillar of separation begins far before our life here that we have physically incarnated into. It starts with source itself. And so this is the most spiritual aspect of the anatomy of loneliness. It's the fact that the thought I creates separation. And when source itself, being the universe at large, thought the thought of I, it was like a cancer that started this division process. So if you can imagine your body just breaking into bits over and over again and not being able to stop that division, that's the way that source felt towards the byproduct of that thought. Because I creates automatically other.
Hmm.
And that was the first time that source itself felt lonely, because in the thought of I, for source itself being everything in existence, there was nothing to relate to.
Hmm.
But that's the thing. That loneliness was created in the universe in an existential way was only created as a byproduct of the first fragment happening within source.
Hmm.
So the way to achieve, the opposite of state of loneliness is bringing that separation back together again. So I of course am explaining in the book this process that happened before your birth and how that applies to our physical concept of separation and I, and how fragmentation that happened in the greater universe is actually what's happening within us. So all people have got these fragments internally. We are all polarities, but we identify with one and we get rid of the other. So we are darkness and light, but we like to identify with light and try to stuff the darkness away, for example. So we are maintaining the state of separation internally.
Doesn't the soul naturally need to separate, though, from the birth and the mother and so forth to become an individual?
Yeah, but individuality is not the end game.
Right. It's the beginning.
Yes, because right now where source is trying to head is back towards oneness again.
It's interesting. Yeah, we come into this world together, and then we separate from the birth parent and become an individual, all just to come back together again.
Yes, we have to choose oneness with our free will. Free will is everything.
Gotcha. Gotcha.
So this is why sometimes you'll see me educating people in the direction of creating very strong boundaries and a very defined sense of self, because it's only by gaining that free will that you can choose into connection. So there's that. But the second pillar of loneliness is shame. Now, most people think that shame is just emotion and it's a byproduct of some sort of painful experience. But shame is actually a biological affective reaction. It is just like fight or flight, actually. So the fight or flight is a mechanism that occurs whether you're thinking about it or not. But what shame does is it's the biological affective movement of pushing yourself away from yourself. If I'm ashamed of something, I think it's bad, I'm going to internally push it away from me. And I can't do that, obviously, because I can't push my own body away from myself in the physical dimension. But what happens is that cognitively it creates a split within the consciousness. I am pushing that part of myself away. Mm. So shame is actually the mechanism of fragmentation internally.
And if you're shamed by others, then...
Well, that's how it happens.
That's usually how it happens. Yeah. Yeah, that does. It is a normal to go into that kind of reaction and defense mode. Yeah, definitely.
Oh,
yeah. And then we internalize it.
Yes.
Okay.
And fear. So fear is,
right
is
into
also
fear.
To push something away. Mm-hmm. Yes. To fear is to push something away. It is the opposite of love. You think about anything you fear. The movement that is happening energetically within you, emotionally, mentally, is to push that thing away from yourself. Now, you can't push something away from yourself without also being separated from it. So you are creating your own loneliness by virtue of pushing that thing away.
Right. And that's
so
something that's about control, too.
Yes.
I mean, if you can control your situation.
It all spells separation, if you look at them.
Mm-hmm. It's all about separation and bringing back the pieces of your disenfranchised self together again. The way that you say to do that is to recognize these things and to really pay attention to them. Is there a step beyond that, or does it naturally happen? Yes.
Well, anything that you really devote your consciousness to, it creates a kind of an alchemical reaction that goes in the direction of healing, which is integration. But the step beyond that is that when we really acknowledge an aspect of ourselves so as to completely understand it again, we are brought closer through that understanding and through meeting the need of that aspect. So, for example, let's say that I've cut off from the aspect of me that really needs someone, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's not okay to need somebody. When I become aware, oh my gosh, there's a part of me that is actually desperately anxious in relationships and really needs somebody. Okay, I have to see that's valid. It's valid to need somebody. And I can't get away from the need. So what are some ways in my day-to-day life that I can come closer to people in a way that would be safe? Because I need people. And when even that thought, and that's not even going so far as to actually, you know, decide what action that is. Even that thought just brought me closer to that part. It's part of accepting it. I'm owning it, and part of owning it is meeting the needs of that disenfranchised self. And by doing that, I bring it closer. I let it know that it's important to me. And I end up with a life that's a real fusion of both of these sides. So the one side is saying, I want to stay safe, though, from being left. And the one side is saying, but I need people. Okay, so how do I find people who aren't going to leave?
Mm-hmm. How do I find safe
people? Those
two
aspects. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how do you? I mean, loneliness is safe in a way because you can control your environment.
But that's the mentality that needs to change. Like I feel like so much of getting out of this is really looking at that belief, because we do have that belief. But is it safe, really? When we start to question that so that we see that it's actually not safe, it's the opposite of safety, we have an opening to say, okay, maybe this way of coping has not really served me that well.
Well, it's safe in the fact that you can control your environment, but then people also turn to social media for connection. Do you think that's safe?
Well, I think that it has its upside and downsides, just like everything. And I think it can be safe, and I think it can also be super not safe. And I think it can be a great way of connecting. It can also be used as an escape. The sort of the scary part of navigating the physical reality is that every tool can be a tool that hurts or a tool that heals.
That's
so
true.
It's about being consciously aware of whether, like, what role that particular tool is serving in your life at a specific time. But one of the ways that I found to make relationships super, super safe, ironically, is to be authentic.
Yeah, gee, imagine that. You have...
Well, because it doesn't feel safe, yeah.
You're in a relationship now?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. How did that... how did you get into a safe relationship, Teal, after all that you had been through? How did you learn to trust again?
Well, I would say that trust is really an ongoing process with me. I wouldn't say that I've just woken up and automatically trusted people even now. And I think that actually, you know, teaching oneself to trust no matter what is pretty dumb, honestly, because there are some people that really shouldn't be trusted. Mm-hmm. That's just the reality.
Mm-hmm.
So, what it was for me is that I realized that I could not continue this horrifically painful and isolating experience of pretending to be something that I wasn't. Like, my whole life, I maintained a double life. That was what I was doing with my whole family and everybody in school. And so there was this separation between what I was experiencing and what I was showing to people when I was around them. And that, it was me creating that separation. And I saw very clearly that the less authentic I was, the less the relationships that I had in my life were real relationships. Nobody was actually in a relationship with me. They were in a relationship with some mask I was, you know, toting around.
Mm-hmm. So, and you could see that.
But it got to a point where, as scary as it was, I was like, I can't do it anymore. Like, I am actually dying of loneliness. So if I just act authentic, you know, I got to the point where it was like, it's worth people just leaving, because I would rather them just say, oh, I'm not in for this, I don't like this about you, and, you know, piss off, rather than spend my whole life lonely with people. So I got authentic, and that was when I started to have real relationships. I started to have people who were like, you know what, that's my jam too.
No, I love that. And you found other authentic people. You mentioned boundaries and having strong boundaries. How did you learn what boundaries were?
Oh, my God. I don't even remember. Let me think about this. You know, I don't even know. Okay. So when I was doing the episode that I did on boundaries, which was really the beginning of me teaching about boundaries, I went out of body. And I looked at the universe in terms of what a boundary was, and it was just definition. So I started to see that boundaries, it's not like a fence, you know. It's not like, oh, this is my land and this is your land. We're only concerned with property, for example, and there's a conflict of interest. But what really constituted the majority of a boundary was a person's sense of self. So even when I say something like, my favorite ice cream is coffee ice cream, that's a boundary. It's something that uniquely defines me. And when we get into trouble, boundary trouble in relationships is when I have a want or a need and another person has a conflicting want or need.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we open the door wide for boundary conflict and boundary encroachment and boundary violation.
What about people who have too many boundaries? Like, they are unwielding for anyone else's opinion in their life.
Well, they're pretty much doomed to having no relationships.
Same thing, right? Same type of loneliness, right? Or they just stick to their way and only know their way.
Well, here's where this brings... People love to think that boundaries are a contradiction to oneness, but they're not. Because part of my sense of self, when I become more aware and more aware, my sense of self starts to include other people. And when I include other people as part of me, I can no longer oppose their best interests, because their best interests are part of my best interests.
Mm-hmm.
So now I have to play a game of how do I meet both of our needs in the best way possible.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when relationships get safe. That is the definition of a safe relationship. A safe relationship is when both parties involved can take the other person's best interest as part of their own.
Wow. Now that's very inclusive. That's beautiful. I just want to mention to anyone who's listening, if you have a question for Teal Swan, if you want to give us a call, again, my guest is Teal Swan. You can look her up on YouTube. And the latest book that she has out is called The Anatomy of Loneliness. And it answers so many questions. We were just talking about strong boundaries and how to have a relationship. And you have, tell me a little bit about how you manage your relationship. Is it, you know, with your partner, with your child, with everything around you, how do you have those boundaries and yet at the same time not be lonely?
It's very simple. I've surrounded myself with people who are capable of taking my best interest to heart and vice versa. So when I need to make a decision, I express that decision. I express, you know, what I want, my wants, my needs. That's what a boundary is. So in this moment, this is what I need. Now, what do you need? And we take a look at that. And if it's conflicting, we both of us, because we care about each other's best interests, because it's part of our own, we find a way to make that harmonious. So let's say that Graciela is a good example. So I have a woman who's been living with me for 5 years. She's like my right hand, and we're, you know, love each other to death. So I will wake up and I'll say, okay, today I really need to be fed because I've got interviews the whole day. So that's my need. And she'll say, okay, well, let me think about this then, because what I need to do is to fit some of the sessions that I do, because she does emotional work with people. I need to fit the sessions that I do in somewhere today. So how about if I feed you breakfast, I do, you know, something at 10 o'clock, and then I'll feed you lunch. So it's a good example of how we're taking each other's best interests as part of ourselves and mm-hmm. making a harmonious decision based off of that considers both of our needs.
Mm-hmm.
And when that doesn't work, there's incompatibility. And I've definitely had those relationships, believe me, many of them.
What
the
do you
reality
do?
Is that there is no way.
Yeah. What do you do when you find that relationship that doesn't work? Are you okay and you don't need to appease people by being peaceful, right?
There isn't a way for an incompatible relationship to work. There's no way to beat around the bush. You cannot make it work, because what will happen is that one of you will have to give up a part of your happiness for the other person and vice versa. And that breeds resentment. That's all that happens. So the relationship is just a matter of time before it deteriorates. This is why I'm teaching so aggressively lately on compatibility specifically.
What do you say to that person where you know you're incompatible?
We're incompatible. Look, yeah, I'm pretty straightforward. I'm like, look, this is not going to happen. And I mean, when I have somebody in my life like that, it's pretty obvious to them too, but
yeah.
We play it out.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what does this look like in 2 years, 5 years, 6 years?
That's a great way of doing it. But what happens if it's something like your boss or somebody who is, you know, has a responsibility over you and you're not compatible with them?
Same thing. Like, you can't make that work. You have to find a different option.
Yeah.
And this is what I decided even with my son. Like, okay, so let's go here. My son is the kind of person who has a brain that loves building. I hate building. We couldn't be more incompatible that way.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I'm not going to spend time with him miserable. So my option to have a relationship with my son is to find some third thing that he and I love doing. But my commitment as a parent is, because that compatibility is really important for him, I've got to find somebody in his life for him to spend time with that loves that building with him.
Mm-hmm. And then you spend time with him doing the things that both of you love.
Yeah.
Great point. Absolutely great point. Rosabella is calling in. She has a question for you. Hi, Rosabella. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you so much for your show. I love it so much.
Awesome. I'm glad you're listening. Tell me, do you have a question for T.L. Swan?
Yes. I've been listening, and I feel so inspired by what you're saying, T.L., but for me, it's been a conflict that's been going on for about a year, and it's about how do I balance or navigate through wanting to live up to oneness and being connected to the people around me and the world around me, but also setting up proper boundaries with people that I feel have been very hurtful and just very, encroaching in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What I would say to that is it's super important to set up those boundaries, because what the universe wants for a lot of those people that are causing those problems is to experience the byproduct of their action. So a lot of us think we're saving people, you know, when we're preventing them from the consequences of their actions towards us. But sometimes mm-hmm. cutting people loose from your life makes it so that they end up in a space where they're just lonely enough that they realize that they have done this to themselves by virtue of not really taking other people's best interests to heart, for example. So it's not actually a contradiction to oneness.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying the people in her life that are not compatible with her, it's best to let those people go because it's hurting both of you.
Yes.
That's a boundary. Yeah. That's a boundary. It's just a matter of also feeling confident, not comfortable. Naturally, as women, we are peacemakers. It comes from a long lineage of peacemaking women. And it's one of the things that you're saying here, Teal, that goes against a little bit of that peacemaking. Can you address that with women?
Well, women have basically survived for thousands of years by being completely codependent.
Uh-huh.
Because our survival was dependent upon meeting our needs by meeting somebody else's needs. So our way of being self-centered was to meet everyone else's needs so we could get our own met. And I think we're in a space and time where that's superbly unhealthy, because we're actually not only fueling our dysfunction, but the people around us. And we have to really be aware of how much we're enabling other people. And women are really bad with this in terms of relationships, especially with men. We enable all kinds of dysfunction, thinking that it's in their best interest because we're the only one that can love them. But really, we're just giving them an excuse to get away from awareness.
Does that make sense to you? Did it answer
your
question?
Absolutely. It hits the, I mean, because that's one of the things where if I'm trying to be loving and, but I don't realize that either I'm being enabling or not allowing for the other person to feel that consequence of their hurtful actions. So absolutely.
It makes sense.
Thank you so much.
And then, and thank you. And I'll just ask you this question. What about the concept of oneness that she was originally asking about? What do you feel about that, Teal?
What about the concept of oneness?
Yeah, I mean, so she's really trying to create boundaries and get people out of her life that don't work. But yet
here's the practice, okay? Connection. If you want to feel a sense of oneness, you got to find other people in yourself. So it's not really as much about what do I do with that external relationship. It's how do I find that person in me? So, for example, let's say that I have a guy in my life who's, like, really emotionally unavailable. I got to find the part within me that's emotionally unavailable, because that's what this person is reflecting. I also got to find the part in me that's traumatized by, you know, in my childhood, traumatized by that, because I would only be finding that in my adult life, for example, if I had some unresolved issue there. And most of, in our romantic lives, this is especially true. We are constantly finding reincarnations of our relationship with our parents, trying to get a different outcome than what happened in the first place. But of course, we find the same people as our parents and repeat the pattern, and we're re-traumatized. So for me, it would be about that. I find both of those parts, the parts that were, you know, desperately damaged by the part that was, you know, by people in my life being emotionally unavailable, and the part of me that is emotionally unavailable. And once I integrate those parts within me, it becomes very obvious what I want to do with the person on the outside.
It's a process, isn't it? Over and over again.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, I can't.
It gets easier.
Yeah, it gets easier and maybe shorter. I see. Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you so much. Your authenticity and honesty has definitely struck a nerve with our audience, and I really appreciate everything that you've done, Teal. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. The book, again, is called The Anatomy of Loneliness and So Many Others by Teal Swan. You can check her out on YouTube. And I am Lisa Garr. Until next time, I invite you to stay aware.